transition training. If you think it's expensive, try going without it. I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest, as is often the case on Mondays, is Bob Miller. Bob is a certified flight instructor and publishes the internet newsletter Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. Bob, did you get enough turkey?
I unfortunately had too much, like I'm afraid too many of us did.
Guilty. Well, listen, we're starting a new month with, unfortunately, an accident to discuss that is fairly close to you, and in this case, you even knew the pilot.
Yes, we had a loss this past month of a friend, a colleague of mine, and who had acquired a Cirrus SR-22. And let me just say at the onset that the Cirrus SR-22 is one of the finest airplanes in the sky today. It, along with the Cessna 400, is just the state of the art in terms of reliability and safety. But this individual had acquired one. He had it 3 weeks. He and his wife took it from Buffalo with a stop in Ohio and down to Tallahassee to visit relatives. And as some of our listeners may have no doubt have heard, has suffered a fatal accident while on final approach to the Tallahassee airport. And it just simply drives home the point that I've tried to make to my readers over the last 5 years that airplanes in the hands of proficient pilots, well-trained pilots, pilots who are current, are incredibly safe. They literally are a walk in the park. But to an individual that may have not been current or may not have had adequate transition instruction or initial instruction, particularly in these sophisticated glass composite, carbon composite airplanes, there simply needs to be more done. I'd like to be able to think we could do it on a voluntary basis, but I'm beginning to think that maybe some regulatory intervention may be necessary to address this particular problem.
Well, let me ask you about this particular case, because this is a pilot who was instrument rated, apparently, had been flying a Piper Archer for some time. And I understand your situation, your position on the aircraft and the transition requirement. But frankly, Bob, I was struggling to find anything in this accident report at least the factual report from the NTSB that said to me this could not have happened in his Piper Archer. This looked to me almost to be more of a general proficiency question than an aircraft transition question.
It could very well be, but things in the Cirrus and in the Cessna 400, and I use these airplanes interchangeably. Again, I don't want to indict the airplane. They're wonderful airplanes, but they're fast. Things happen much more quickly. They're nimble. They're very responsive. We don't have a big two ham-fisted yoke to work with. We have a little 6-inch joystick type of control that we use with our wrist and our fingers, and under normal VFR conditions, this is a very easy airplane to fly. But if we get into IFR conditions, and we're not current, a little mistake in an Archer magnifies itself to a very big mistake in an airplane like the Cirrus or the Cessna 400.
Okay, now let's talk about this particular aircraft, because this may have combined the worst of both possible worlds. One is that it has all the performance that a brand new SR-22 would have. However, according to the NTSB, it had an MFD, but it had no primary flight display. So I imagine it must have been navigated still by round dials.
Well, yes, but again, according to the preliminary report, he had difficulty tracking the localizer. He carved a serpentine pattern along the localizer, left and then right, and the MFD displays a very nice moving map, a very large moving map, that just glancing slightly to the right, he could see his airplane literally displayed on the moving map, which doesn't, to me, explain how he was left and right, other than he was not proficient on the gauges. But when we're not proficient on the gauges at 90 knots, or even 80 knots in an Archer, imagine not being proficient on the gauges if we're carrying 120 knots or possibly 130 knots. Things just happen a whole lot more quickly. Paul, you're absolutely right. This is an instrument proficiency, appears, I should say, to be an instrument proficiency problem. But as anybody who's been involved in a stressful situation in an airplane or in any airplane, our ability to think and to process information deteriorates quickly. And he may have just resigned himself to the fact that he was overloaded. In fact, he was quoted in the NTSB report saying when the controller last spoke with him, he said, gotta go, almost as if he realized he was in a situation that was over his head.
Well, let's talk about what would have happened if he was transitioning in the other direction, because a question I have is, no matter what the two aircraft are or which one has the higher performance, if you move from one aircraft type into another, just the difference in the environment when things start to increase your workload, any two aircraft that behave differently would represent an opportunity for this kind of tragedy to happen, would they not?
No question. Absolutely no question. I have to come back to the fact that this individual had this airplane for 3 weeks before the accident occurred. I understand he had a total of 15 hours in the airplane. I'm not sure how many hours of that was with an instructor. But again, flying VFR on a nice calm day is one thing. But if we suddenly find ourselves in IMC conditions, particularly if they were not forecast, and I believe in this instance, the weather was deteriorating quite rapidly.
Yes.
So he may have fully expected to make a normal VFR approach to landing and then have found himself enshrouded in IMC conditions. And you're right, whichever kind of an airplane it is, that's no place to be.
Well, Bob, when we come back from the break, let's talk about two things. One is, what do we need to do as pilots to stay on the right side of this? And second, how much of that should be mandated? My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Paul Platt. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Do you feel stimulated? Hey, that's why Congress passed the Economic Stimulus Act of 2008, so loyal Americans like yourself would feel stimulated to help rev up the economy by spending money on important stuff like new Garmin avionics. We're talking potential tax incentives, bonus depreciation up to 50% in first-year cost allowances for qualified business use equipment purchases. See your tax advisor for guidance and your Garmin dealer for one whale of a stimulus package. It's almost like your patriotic duty, huh? Garmin, follow the leader.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves. And we're talking about proficiency and the specific proficiency requirements of moving from maybe your traditional aircraft into something with higher performance, one of the new composite planes, high-performance aircraft. And we're talking specifically because of an accident that happened to a pilot who had transitioned from a Piper Archer into a Cirrus SR-22 and had fairly limited experience, found himself in IFR, and it ended up being his last flight. Bob, what do we do to make sure this does not happen to us?
Well, I put together for an upcoming article on this very subject the essential elements in transition training, particularly as we go from a more simple airplane to a more complex, higher-performing airplane. And I came up, there are other variations on this, but I came up with six elements that should absolutely be mastered before turning ourselves loose, certainly in IFR conditions. The first one is aircraft systems. That transition training must include in-depth understanding of the aircraft systems, particularly primary, secondary, and emergency electrical bus operation and management. These are all electric airplanes. Everything works off of either one, two, or in some cases three alternators, two separate independent electrical buses. We need to understand how those systems work and how we can shed power and transfer power between the two. Number two, the avionics systems on these airplanes are extremely sophisticated. We have to understand how the automatic heading reference system, the AHAR system, works, how the air data computer system works, and how they are integrated into the onboard navigation system. These two areas alone should take at least 10 hours of ground school to master. It takes 3 weeks to be type-rated in a Learjet, and that's a two-pilot airplane. Here we have an individual going into a single airplane with nearly the same performance, certainly on landing, and we're not seeing any of this kind of training mandated. Number three, autopilot operation. Mastery of the autopilot, the flight director system, and any of the related automatic controls. The Cirrus SR-22 is perfectly capable of shooting a coupled approach to IFR minimums. This means the autopilot can fly that entire approach safely and with precision right down to minimums. And had he had the autopilot working and just under normal coupling fashion, what we saw on the radar track would not have happened. He would have just been steered right down the localizer and glide slope. Number four, aircraft control. Here we see most of the accidents occur during maneuvering operations. We need to have specific training in slow flight, stalls, steep turns, unusual attitude recovery long before an individual should be taking an airplane like this into IFR conditions. And five, speaking of IFR operations, we must be able to develop mastery on the gauges, on the glass, partial panel. If something goes wrong with the primary flight display, or the steam gauges, can we quickly transfer over to the multifunction display and keep the airplane upright in the clouds? And then lastly, emergency procedures. We need to know precisely what to do at the right time when something goes wrong in these airplanes. We need to commit correct emergency procedures to memory. This is something that cannot be done in 5 hours of transition training. Unless we find some way to have our owners, the owners of these airplanes, do this voluntarily, I think the insurance companies in some cases are stepping in and requiring longer periods of transition training. But I believe that something's going to have to be done to mandate something akin to a type rating when transitioning to a composite aircraft that has the capability of doing 200 knots in the air.
I think in many cases, the insurance industry may be as effective as changes in regulations, because frankly, they're going to be less bashful about asking for more from us. But let me talk briefly about the plane. You mentioned autopilot. The NTSB report, factual report, didn't say anything about an autopilot. A Cirrus SR-22 obviously should have come equipped with one. There are plenty of people who say you shouldn't be flying an IFR in a single pilot operation in any case without a functioning autopilot. What do you think went wrong here? Why was he trying to find this manually? I mean, the NTSB reviewed communications, and the controller told him he was off course and needed to turn to 240 degrees, and he mentioned that a couple of times, and it didn't happen.
Well, you know, if we don't program the autopilot correctly, it's not a foolproof device. It's foolproof in keeping the wings level, and it's pretty much foolproof in maintaining altitude. But when we are being vectored to a final approach course, and we turn on the autopilot with a full expectation that it will couple up, if we don't do it right, for example, if we come in high on the localizer, high on the glide slope, or we don't program it correctly, we don't have the headings where we want, it will not couple up. And this could very easily have happened. It's happened to me, where you fully expect the autopilot to couple up with the approach procedure, and it doesn't. And now we're struggling to disconnect the autopilot at the same time, trying to maintain some position awareness, and we're transitioning from a button pushing pilot to a stick and rudder pilot, all while possibly in turbulence, in a very strange environment. It can be, frankly, more of a workload than we can handle if we're anything less than proficient. Let's ask ourselves, why is a type rating required for a jet that's most typically is flown with two people, and not required for an SR-22 or a Cessna 400 that's flown by one person with the same probability or possibility of having an untoward event? I don't understand that, other than the fact that we have forces within the GA community that's trying to minimize the burden on pilots, trying to keep as many people in the sky without, in their words, burdening them with additional responsibilities for recurrent training or for more extensive initial training. But if, unless something is done, I think the public is going to eventually become outraged with this, if not the insurance company. My own community here in Buffalo, New York, I mean, this was a prominent couple that lost their lives in this airplane. I was the chairman of a board of a major organization here in town, among other activities. And people were riveted to the news, wondering and asking what in the world happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I could feel it right in my own flight school when individuals who are in the midst of purchasing these high-performance airplanes, they're getting pressure from their wives or their spouses saying, you know, I don't know if I want you flying this. They're dangerous, you know. Well, they're not.
Mm-hmm.
They're not dangerous. But we have to take specific steps to make them not dangerous.
All right, so we've got in the December issue of Over the Airwaves, for that matter, your six steps that you mentioned a moment ago are outlined. If we want to pursue this, what would be a reasonable budget for time, money, and effort to put into this? What is this going to take for us?
All right, I have a student, a primary student, who purchased a 1950 Cessna 170 tail dragger. His insurance requires him to have 25 hours of dual before he can solo that airplane because he has no tail dragger time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is an airplane that lands at 65 knots. Very simple, very docile, and sure, a tail dragger has its own unique little challenges, particularly on landing. 25 hours. Now, this individual who took this airplane to his demise, as far as we can tell, had 15 hours total time in the Cirrus SR-22 and probably only 5 or 6 or 7 hours of transition training. I mean, you can see the difference right there.
Right.
And why? I don't know. But I would call, if I were in a position to make regulatory change, I would call for a minimum of 25 to 30 hours of transition time, combination flight time, and mandated ground time, and a sign-off by a factory-trained instructor. And anything less than that, I don't think the job can be done.
Well, as always, we'll invite listeners to read more at overtheairwaves.com. Bob, as always, we appreciate your point of view. Thanks for taking some time out for us today, and we'll look for you again next Monday.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.